I call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, March 5th, 2025. The time is 3:30 p.m. Please turn off cell phones. Members present, Senator Hughes, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Wilikowski, and myself, Senator Giesel. We have a quorum to conduct business. I do recognize that Senator Myers has joined us. Welcome. I expect Senator Dunbar along shortly, as well as Senator Klayman. Thank you to Heather and to Emma for recording the minutes and helping us with the audio. We have three things to execute today on the agenda. First of all, we have a governor's appointee, Jesse Chmielewski. I probably butchered that, sorry. AOGCC commissioner. We're going to take public hearing on her appointment. Then we'll hear Gaffney Klein, global LNG market, and lastly, Alaska statehood defense. So immediately we'll take up the consideration of the governor's appointee, Jesse Chmielewski, to the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. We are bringing this before us again just to open up public testimony once more. We interviewed her on Monday. So at this time, I will open public testimony on this appointment. I see no one online wishing to testify on Ms. Chmielewski's appointment to the commission. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. And with that, I will turn to Senator Wilikowski for a motion.
Madam Chair, the Senate Resources Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee and recommends that the following name be forwarded to a joint session of the Alaska Legislature for consideration. Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, Jesse Chmielewski. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against this individual during any further sessions for purposes of confirmation.
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Seeing no objection, the motion passes. We will sign the document before we leave today. I'm not going to take a pause at this time to sign that document. We're going to move right on to Gaffney Klein and the presentation on the global LNG market. So I will welcome Nicholas Fulford to the table. He is the Senior Director, LNG and Energy Transition, Gaffney Klein Energy Advisory. So welcome, Mr. Fulford. We look forward to your presentation.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. And for the record, my name is Nick Fulford with Gaffney Klein. And I'm also looking forward to giving the presentation. Before I get into the main body of the materials, I wanted to make a few comments about the sort of context of the LNG industry and how it might apply to Alaska. I've been working on LNG projects myself since probably the mid-1980s, so, you know, certainly a few observations which I think are helpful. The first is that for any LNG project, I think it's essential that you take a very kind of long-term view and perspective on the project. Many of these projects take a long time even to arrive at some sort of commercially sustainable structure. And then, of course, they take a long time to build. And really, for most applications, the real financial benefit of them probably shows up kind of about a generation down the road. So they're not quick wins, but when you have got them in place, they can transform an economy. So in terms of today's presentation structure, I wanted to talk a little bit about the evolution of the LNG industry, how it's come together, its growth, the different features that have brought us to where we are today. I wanted to talk about supply and demand as well, because obviously for any aspirational project these days, there are some particular features around demand and supply which haven't been present before, but have become quite important. Thirdly, I wanted to talk about how an LNG project comes together and really some of the features which make the difference between a commercially viable project and one that will spin its wheels, if you like, for some time. Obviously, economics is absolutely key, and so that's another feature I wanted to cover. And then finally, enabling legislation, which I know, Senator Giesel, you in particular have been through this a few times before, and you'll remember the Senate Bill 138 and so forth, which began to lay the foundation for that type of legislation some 10 years ago. The very last slide is a kind of a case study looking at projects that have worked, ones that haven't for different reasons, and sort of thinking about how that might relate to Alaska. So with that, I'll move on to talking about really the history and the growth. So today's market, LNG market, is about 400 million tons per annum. So to put that in context, that is about 20 trillion cubic feet per year of feedstock used for that. And perhaps another helpful reference, the original Alaska project in Nikiski, way back in 69, at the time it was the biggest project ever undertaken. It was the first in the Eastern Pacific, so that kind of resonates a little bit with where you are today. But the delivery from that was about 1.5 million tons per annum, which, as it happens, is about what South Central Alaska is using today. So that gives you a little bit of context in terms of where the industry's come from and where it is today. I've put some of the bigger exporting countries on this graph just to show, you know, how they arose and when they started exporting. And obviously we've been through quite a few manifestations, but perhaps the most significant of which was the emergence of the U.S. Thank you. The emergence of the U.S. as a major LNG exporters. And certainly from my own experience, the speed with which the U.S. has gone from not exporting any LNG at all to becoming the biggest LNG exporter as it is today has been nothing short of extraordinary and has shaken up the LNG industry in some many ways. So it's definitely introduced a different perspective on the industry as it is today, and I'll go into some of that. But really the last, well, right now, the three big exporters are the three in red here, Australia, Qatar, and the US. And as we look forward, and I'll show you some data on this, really the supply from now on will be largely from Qatar on the one hand, who have very low-cost gas that they can produce, and the USA. Now, whether that's just U.S. Gulf Coast or West Coast or obviously Alaska remains to be seen. But that's really how things stand today. I took this snapshot on Monday of LNG traffic around the world. The green is loaded, red is ballast. And I even surprised myself with how this looked, because you'll notice that there are only actually five LNG vessels in the whole of the Eastern Pacific on this map. Three of them come from Peru. Two of them had either transited or were about to transit the Panama Canal on the way from the U.S. Gulf Coast. So as you think about Alaska today and the need for supply diversity and portfolio management that many Asian buyers are looking at today, what you can see is that an LNG trade from Alaska down into the Pacific avoids many of the risks and costs involved elsewhere. The other thing that I noticed from this snapshot yesterday is you'll see the amount of LNG traffic that's going around, passing through the southern part of Africa and back up into Asia. That's because the Suez Canal is not considered safe these days for the LNG industry. I think one or two ships may have used it. But that, too, adds cost and complexity and risk to a buyer. So in short, you know, it does place a little bit of a focus on Pacific as being, you know, potentially strategically valuable for a potential future buyer. So I wanted to spend a little bit of time now on the supply and demand. And you know, perhaps before I do that, it'd be good to think about the last 5 years in the industry. Now, obviously, in many ways, because of COVID, because of the unrest in Russia, Ukraine, etc., and the very significant disruptions to European gas demand, that has caused a degree of unprecedented price volatility over the last few years. In the sort of 2020-21 timeframe, we were seeing both, somewhat of an oversupply in the LNG industry, and then we saw the demand drop because of COVID. And around that time, LNG prices fell to levels, you know, certainly from a spot trade or a gas index point of view, they fell to levels that had never been seen before. And in fact, some of the U.S. export terminals were mothballed briefly because it was cheaper to pay the capacity fee than to take the loss on the gas. Fast forward a few months, one LNG cargo from the U.S. was fetching of the order of $200 million, which is about what the ship itself costs. So that gives you a sense of just how valuable those cargoes became. But thankfully, well, we've learned two things from that. One is that the LNG industry is far more robust and flexible than perhaps it had been given credit for. And the fact that the gas shortfalls in Europe were largely met with exported US LNG and substitutions were made elsewhere to sort of keep gas markets going, I think was a testimony to the sort of creativity and the flexibility that was achieved. But equally, it has raised other issues in terms of LNG and gas generally. And what now that we're kind of through the crisis, if you like, of the last few years, we're coming back to look at effectively what's on this next slide, which is truly what is the demand for LNG going forwards. We looked at 10 forecasts, four of them, and you can see there which four, are based around various kind of net zero scenarios. And the way I would describe these forecasts is that they were kind of back calculated from a kind of limitation around carbon emissions in terms of, okay, well, if we're limiting carbon emissions to this, what's the degree of gas production that the world can sustain? So for the most part, that's where those forecasts have come from. On the other hand, towards the upper side of the forecasts, we've got many of the international energy companies, you know, Shell, BP, Exxon, etc., who are continuing to base, you know, a lot of their sort of growth plans on an anticipated expansion of the LNG market. And in fact, Shell published their LNG outlook for 2025 just last week, and they're putting in a 700 million ton per annum forecast as opposed to 400 where it is today. Largely, it's you know, based on pretty well a doubling of primary energy requirements over the next few years to 2050, and an expectation that gas and LNG will more or less keep pace with that. So what's happening elsewhere in that equation is that coal and oil are reducing in demand. They're being replaced by renewables and other low-carbon fuels. But gas is holding its own. And for the most part, a lot of that demand is coming from parts of Asia, countries like Vietnam, who you know, rapidly growing economy, which will be based on LNG largely as a fuel. excuse me. So that's kind of where things stand in terms of forecast. So if we now turn and do pause me if there are any questions, I'm sure you will, Cheggy's on.
Absolutely. I don't see any right now.
Okay. So in terms of where the capacities come from, what you can see here is that over the last, well, certainly 10 years ago, a lot of the additional capacity was coming from Africa, parts of the Middle East, and in Latin America, etc. But over the last, really since about 2019, where the U.S. sort of LNG initiatives have really taken off, you can see that almost all the added capacity over the last few years has come from new U.S. Gulf Coast capacity. And as you look forward, the other feature you can see on that curve, which is the blue bar, is the Qatari expansion. So they're building four new trains, very material increase in LNG production, all based around the North Field, which is the biggest gas field in the world and continues seemingly to have a lot of resource ready to deliver from it. So that's where things have come from and what will dominate the next few years. But as we go back to that supply uncertainty that we were looking at earlier, and we project the projects which are either, well, existing, under construction, or have been announced with a date, and that's an important qualification, that there are a lot of projects which have been announced but have no date or certainty around them. But that's really what the outcome looks like. So what you can see here, I'm sure you'll all have read some of the discussion about the oversupply over the next few years, and certainly in the sort of 2030 timeframe, depending on the outcome of some of the legal and regulatory challenges that we're seeing increasing in the U.S. Gulf Coast, certainly a lot more gas will come on. Two or three of the projects have announced a delay in their startup dates. And, while maybe a year ago you might have thought that 2030 would bring, a glut of LNG, as you read in the papers sometimes, it's looking a little bit more balanced than that, I think, in reality. And by the 2035 timeframe, you're looking at, a much more material development of demand, which, from an Alaska perspective, is potentially beneficial.
Yes. Excuse me, Senator Hughes has a question.
Thank you. I'm having trouble seeing the little keys, but from what I'm looking at, it looks like the bottom blue band and the brown, the bottom blue is existing, and the brown band on top of it is under construction. And so what is above it is just pretty much announced. So the for sure is kind of the blue and the brown. Is that correct?
Yes, Senator Hughes, that's broadly accurate. Through the chair, the brown is actually, or the sort of dark red is facilities that are under construction in Asia. But what you'll notice dominates that bar is the yellow, which is under construction in the Americas, and the brown, which is under construction in the Middle East. So you could read those two as being U.S. Gulf Coast and Qatar.
Is it a follow-up?
Follow-up,
so above the yellow, then, is things that are announced and hoped for. Is that kind of correct? And then the orange line is the need, the demand.
That's correct, through the chair. The orange line is, I would say, a relatively conservative line of demand. It's the medium that sits between the net zero projections and the more positive projections that most of the international energy companies are following. So I think a more balanced or, arguably a more pragmatic way of looking at that would be to perhaps put less emphasis on those four scenarios that involve decarbonization and a little bit more emphasis on the IEC work, in which case that demand line, that yellow solid line there would be higher.
Thank you.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, we're looking at world supply and demand here. Is that because the Asian or the Pacific versus Atlantic markets can commingle enough that it works to that, or do they functionally operate as two separate markets?
Thank you, Senator Myers, and through the chair. One of the advantages of the LNG industry is that it can switch. So to the extent that you've got weather effects in Asia, or Europe, gas can be diverted. Sometimes it's even reloaded onto a ship from somewhere it's already been delivered and sent back. So you get these reloads, which happen in Europe. Spain, for example, they do a lot of reloads, and they take it to, you know, where it's needed. But from a shipping logistics point of view, it's much better and easier to keep vessels in either the Atlantic or the Pacific, partly, you know, because you've got the canal fees and so forth to deal with. But it can operate globally, and this kind of balance between the Atlantic and the Pacific is always sort of being managed dynamically.
Okay. Follow-up?
No, I'm good, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Hughes.
Yes, I just thought of something else. I'm assuming that the the orange band for the potential demand includes the what we've been hearing lately about the increased need for energy related to AI. I've heard that that might quadruple the need, so does that take that into account?
Senator Hughes, through the chair, I think I would agree that gas-fired generation for the use of data centers in support of AI is an emerging trend. Even now, I think 15% of power demand is for data centers. So that would kind of relate across to the LNG. These specific numbers, they don't have a particular element for that. So it could be viewed as an upside.
Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. How does Alaska LNG compare cost-wise with some of the other major projects we're seeing around the world in Qatar and the Gulf of U.S.?
So, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I've got a couple of slides later on in the presentation which deal with that in more detail. But one of the important bits of understanding, I think, that hopefully this presentation will convey is, you know, around how the cost of Alaska LNG is perceived. It's often referred to as a costly project, and it is, from the point of view of initial pre-productive capital, it's a very costly project because not only does it involve liquefaction, but you've got the pipeline and the processing plant. But once you set that aside, its kind of running costs are much lower, for example, than the Gulf Coast. So the shipping costs are low. It remains to be seen what the cost of the feedstock would look like, but in all the scenarios that have been put forward, it's around $1 or $1.50. So, again, I think it's an important takeaway. In terms of its competitive position with the Gulf Coast LNG, Alaska's vulnerability is capital cost inflation. That's the thing that will materially affect the cost of delivered gas. For the Gulf Coast projects, it's escalation in Henry Hub prices. And inevitably, it's a little bit like the Cook Inlet. You know, the more gas you draw upon, you know, the more you're having to go to more expensive places to get it. And much as there's a huge gas resource in the southern states, ultimately the cost of producing that gas will rise. And the sort of competitive balance between U.S. Gulf Coast and Alaska potentially will improve with it. So as I say, I think, you know, from a cost perspective, when we talk about Alaska being high cost, it's not necessarily the delivered cost. It's the capital cost.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
As you know, AGDC has entered into an agreement with Glenfarne, and I'm curious what is your opinion of Glenfarne's ability to do a project of this magnitude?
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. I did attend the Glenfarne Lunch and Learn that was done here, and obviously, you know, read about their activities. The two projects that they have in the U.S. Gulf Coast are significantly smaller than the Alaska project and what it would involve. However, they do appear to have a fairly successful track record of project development. And you know, I have no sort of information on the project or the way they're negotiating with AGEC for the development agreement. But the fact that any LNG developer is actively talking about participation and moving the project forward is a positive thing. Now, what the project will end up looking like is another question. But as a step in the road, the Glen Farne initiative seems positive.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
Just curious, President Trump last night referenced the Alaska LNG pipeline in his State of the State. What is your sense of what will happen at the federal level and how that's impacting, I guess, discussions in Japan and Korea and Taiwan? I mean, what's your sense of all that? Is this, do you think there's something imminent, or do you think there's something going to happen quickly, or what's your sense of what's happening here?
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion at a federal level since the election about how the Alaska LNG project can be woven into a broader kind of trade discussion with some of the U.S.'s Asian partners. In the old days, if I can put it that way, in the 70s, 80s, LNG projects quite often would be linked with international treaties between the selling country and the buying country, and sometimes those treaties would involve a whole series of other types of collaboration. So, you know, in those days where particularly, you know, LNG sellers and buyers were kind of joined at the hip, because if there was any disruption or perturbation in that kind of LNG supply, you know, from production through liquefaction, shipping, and regas, if there was any upset there, everybody suffered. And therefore, this sort of integrity of the LNG chain was of the utmost importance, which is why you saw these, you know, treaty negotiations, maybe 2, 3, 4 years of kind of dialogue, building trust, and so forth. Now, obviously, the LNG industry today works very differently. And if your LNG supplier doesn't show up, you can get on the phone and get another ship within a few days or a few hours even. But having said that, these kind of gas supply discussions are of such a sort of strategic level that, you know, federal government initiative and, you know, a dialogue at the highest levels of government can only help, I would have thought, particularly if those efforts can be aligned with what I would call the more operational efforts being made, you know, with whether it be AGDC and Glen Farne. I think, you know, potentially bringing those two initiatives together, and I'm sure that's being looked at, I think could be beneficial.
Mr. Fulford, the canary yellow color here is under construction in the Americas. Is that including the Alaska project?
No, it isn't. Chair Giesel.
All right, thank you. I see no other questions. I'll let you move on.
Okay, thank you. So I wanted to talk about project evolution a little bit, and some of these slides speak to some of the dialogue we've just had around, you know, the way in which the project is moving forward. And certainly, you know, one of the most important features of getting an LNG project off the ground is alignment between the stakeholders. Now, that might include the gas producers, it might include the investors in the LNG project, and it might include the buyers too. And establishing a project framework that creates that alignment between all the stakeholders, whoever they are, is absolutely key. And I wanted to briefly touch on three different structures which are typically used in the LNG industry. The first of which is termed an integrated LNG project, and typically this is a structure that you would use where the producers of the gas are investing in equal proportions in the liquefaction in the pipeline, and would take delivery of LNG for onward passage to customers, you know, in the same proportion. So in a way, this is the most straightforward structure, and it creates this kind of alignment between the parties, which saves a lot of time in terms of, you know, transfer pricing and negotiating gas supply agreements and so forth. I think it was, broadly speaking, what was envisaged by the AKLNG project some 10 years ago with Senate Bill 138. And it's been used with success in, you know, Qatar, Sakhalin, Northwest Shelf, for example. So it's a tried and tested approach. But sometimes not everybody involved in the project has the same appetite for risk and investment. So another project that's quite commonly used is termed a merchant project. And typically this would be used where some or all of the gas producers are simply interested in producing the gas and getting a revenue for it, and either don't have the balance sheet or the appetite for investment further down the chain. So under this sort of arrangement, there would be a gas supply agreement between the upstream producers and the liquefaction project, who would then handle the LNG further down. So this has been used on three of the Trinidad projects where, you know, the folks producing the gas were quite happy to do just that without the complication of LNG. And then the... So this is a structure which could work in Alaska, depending on how the dialogue goes with people who want to put gas into the project. The third popular model is referred to as a tolling model. It's a little bit like building an airport or a toll road or a bridge or something. So a series of investors, you know, potentially financial investors, would put up the money for the project. And they would develop they would receive a steady income over many, many years based on good credit, strong balance sheets, which would enable them to generate what I'd call a modest return, but would not necessarily include any kind of commodity risk. So it could be completely insulated from any kind of LNG price perturbations. So those are three possibilities which have pros and cons. But as I say, the key is not so much the structure that's adopted. It's choosing one which creates alignment. And certainly for some projects we've seen in the past, adopting a structure which doesn't create that alignment, that can delay things by months or years quite easily. So finally, I wanted to talk about contract model evolution. I mentioned earlier that the LNG industry has changed, and that, you know, this sort of sanctity of the LNG supply chain from liquefaction to ships to delivery has changed with it. So it still happens that an LNG project will sell production, sell volume directly to a gas utility or a power generator in Japan or Korea or wherever it happens to be. And a lot will depend on the sort of presence of different entities in that LNG project. However, more recently, you know, LNG Canada, Rovuma in Mozambique, Grand Tortue in Senegal, they've adopted a slightly different approach, which is to say, well, effectively, you know, I'm going to buy the LNG from the project and I'm going to transfer it into my LNG trading affiliate. That works well from a number of perspectives. The lenders love it because they can see that the offtake is going to a well-capitalized, credit-worthy entity. And as the LNG trading model has evolved, what's become clear is that the profitability of that trading model can be very high if the LNG is traded skillfully. Obviously, you can lose a lot of money if it goes wrong. But it means that the LNG project sponsor, particularly if they're involved in producing the gas as well, they can extract value all the way down the chain, right as far as the consumer, by including this kind of LNG trading function. So it has changed things, and you know, depending on what the Alaska LNG project looks like eventually and who's part of it, that idea of equity marketing and the LNG output being taken by a big LNG trader, that's something which could be helpful and considered.
Mr. Fulford, we we're probably about halfway through, if you might want to
speed up.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very briefly, looking at costs and cost escalation, because I know that's a feature which is of interest. And much as it's desirable to look at the project today and say, well, it's economically viable or not, or what the costs are, the fact is that until the project has developed further in the pre-feed and feed process, it's very, very difficult to really put numbers on the project which are more than about the sort of minus 25 plus 40 number which it's probably at the moment. Even after feed, that would achieve about a class 3 cost estimate, what's called the class 3 estimate, which would be minus 20 to plus 25. And at the point where you give the project out to bid, then you get still further, but still not necessarily an exact number. So let's pause a moment and see what's happened in practice. So these are 12 world-class LNG projects that have been built over the last decade or more. And what you can see here is that, typically there have been cost overruns for different reasons. And, some of those, especially the ones in Australia, have been quite material for reasons which I think are quite well understood. I would say U.S. Gulf Coast experience has generally been quite good. And one of the interesting developments in the last few years has been the use of modular liquefaction trains built off-site and floated across. And that, too, has brought about much greater certainty around cost and also time to first gas. Just before we move on, it's worth bearing in mind that cost overruns are undesirable. But the LNG projects themselves have some kind of inherent upside, which typically doesn't appear in the sort of basic economic calculations. It comes from a couple of things. When you build the project, it usually performs about 10% better than the construction guarantees and so forth that you have from the builders. And secondly, it's normal after 2 or 3 years of operations that you'd go through a process to kind of improve the efficiency and generate more value from the same capital. Just very briefly on schedule, that's something which reflects the cost overruns as well. You can see that some of these projects have done reasonably well from a schedule point of view. But again, from a private investor perspective, losing early cash flow is obviously proportionally more damaging to the economics than elsewhere.
Mr. Fulford, Senator Myers had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a real quick one. Previous slide, you referenced de-bottlenecking. Could you explain that?
Certainly, Senator Myers, through the chair. Even a kind of well-designed LNG train, it has to cope with climatic changes. It might not be fully aligned with, for example, the compression might not quite match the heat exchangers and so forth. And after 2 or 3 years of experience, these things become apparent. And a debottlenecking process would be, it would involve a little bit of additional capital expenditure, but the sort of LNG, the extra LNG that you'd get in return is out of proportion to the initial project. So you'd spend a little bit of money, but you'd potentially get up to a sort of 15-20% enhancement. It depends on the project and the technology, but it's a well-proven route.
Mr. Fulford, I can give you another 10 minutes, and then we'll have you back to complete whatever isn't done.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. So probably the 10 minutes is well spent on economics. So very quickly, just three elements of economics, which is worth highlighting. The first is the upstream gas production. So in the context of Alaska, the upstream gas investment and the value of that gas is very low indeed in the context of the project. Where there is substantial value is in the $40-odd billion of investment in the processing pipeline and so forth, and that's what will generate the cash flow. So, you know, just by way of an example, 25% royalty and tax gives you about $250 million a year. But if you fast forward to a scenario where the state owns a 25% equity in the project, and I'm not going to, you know, whether, you know, how that would happen, but if it did, then in 15 or 20 years after start of the project, the free cash flow from the LNG sales would be of the order of $2 to $3 billion, which in the context of the Alaskan budget is potentially quite attractive. But as I say, it comes a generation down the road. I previously mentioned the LNG trading profit center. You can see here both ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips are building this side of their business. And again, that might be of interest, but it's not something that I would envisage the state of Alaska would get involved with. So let's spend a few minutes then on the economics and the cost of delivered gas. Again, I think it can't be overemphasized that the cost of delivery from Alaska and the cost of delivery from the Gulf Coast are very, very different. And obviously what we've got here is simply scenarios. So on the left-hand side, this is what the economics of Gulf Coast LNG looked like, most of last year with Henry Hub trailing along at about $3. What I've used here is the Wood Mac 2022 economics, and I know they've been looked at and tweaked since then, but as a basis. And what you can see is that using those assumptions, you've got about a $7.85 delivered cost from the Gulf and $6.71. It all sounds very precise, obviously very general assumptions. So then for the other two columns, I mentioned that the Gulf Coast has this real vulnerability to Henry Hub. So if you look at the consensus of forecasts, Henry Hub is thought to be about $4.30 by 2030. And you plug that number into the cost of deliveries, and the outcome looks very different. You've got a $9.35 delivered cost instead of $7 something. And then what I did for comparison, I took the Wood Mac numbers and I uplifted them by 30%. And, you know, in that context, with the shipping cost and so forth kept steady, you've still got a price advantage potentially. So, as I say, these are scenarios and they're based on a range of inputs. But I think what you can conclude from that is that, in principle, Alaska could be competitive with U.S. Gulf Coast exports, but it will all hinge around the capital cost. There's a couple of extra upsides on this, and then perhaps it would be an appropriate point to terminate. First of all, the feedstock for the LNG project is coming from associated gas. So certainly for the state of Alaska and from the tax revenue point of view, there are synergies involved in enabling that gas to be produced and marketed, which potentially could have benefits for the state's oil production. Then for the CCUS plant, and I think AGDC may have put some numbers out on this, but you know the tax credit from 45Q translates into about a 10, 15, even $20 discount in terms of the if you factor it into the landed cost in Asia. And then, of course, in the context of some of the federal government discussions, one of the biggest effects on these numbers could be from a federal loan guarantee, which would obviously reduce the cost of debt, reduce the debt service fees and so forth, which on a $45 billion project is extremely material. So so those are some of the upsides which might be taken into account. I think maybe I'll skip over this slide and touch briefly on enabling legislation if there's time. I want to be respectful of the committee's time.
That's fine.
Okay.
Five more minutes left.
Good. So one of the major considerations of any set of LNG investors is what's called fiscal stability. And most LNG projects will seek, and certainly there are plenty of examples of it being granted, such that once you've put all that capital in the ground, the potential for fiscal changes and other detrimental measures by the host government are restricted in some form. Obviously, it creates, you know, constitutional questions around how you restrict future administrations from doing things. But certainly, you know, for example, LNG Canada, this was one of their asks, one of the things that both the BC government and the federal government were able to grant for a period of time. And again, the other thing which, you know, bears emphasis is that, you know, we're talking about a project that in magnitude is the same as the Alaska GDP. So in the context of that, I think it's highly likely that some kind of tailor-made legislation would be required, which might include the upstream, the midstream. It might include some of the provisions on the right-hand side, which, for example, could involve a carry for the state. You know, that's something which occurs quite often with LNG projects, depending on if the state wants to take equity or not. As I've said on the last bullet point there, which we were sort of talking about earlier, it often features in these broader kind of trade discussions or treaties. So that.
Senator Wilkowski, question?
I know we're running out of time, but yeah. Any recommendations would be appreciated. I believe our tax structure right now is probably deficient. It probably doesn't adequately address a lot of the upstream cost issues, the deduction issues. And so to the extent you've reviewed our legislation and you have recommendations, that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator Wilkowski.
Yes.
And through the chair, is that a good point to terminate?
This would be a good place to stop, and we will have you back, Mr. Fulford.
Okay, I shall look forward to it. Thanks very much, Chair Giesel.
Thank you very much. So with that, we will take a brief pause to switch subjects. We're going to talk about Alaska statehood defense next. Thank you, Mr. Fulford. Brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. Our subject is statehood defense overview. We welcome the Attorney General for the State of Alaska, Mr. Treg Taylor. Welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Chair Giesel, esteemed members of the Senate Resource Committee, my name is Treg Taylor. I'm the Attorney General for the State of Alaska. To my right is Corey Mills, who is the deputy that runs the Civil Division for the Department of Law. We want to jump right in it. I know that we will probably run up against time constraints, so I want to give you the overview because you're all seasoned members of this body and understand what statehood defense is. But what is statehood defense? So it's the holding of the federal government to the promises made to the state of Alaska at statehood. And it's assuring that the state of Alaska has the ability to utilize its lands, its waters, and its natural resources in the manner that it deems fit. And so, obviously, statehood defense, Alaska has – the Department of Law has no problems of its own. Our problems are all related to our clients, right? So we deal with their issues, their policy decisions. And so statehood defense would not be complete without the Department of DEC, DNR, and Fish and Game. We meet regularly, weekly, to be more specific, and talk about the issues that are facing Alaska, talk about where litigation is, what we see coming down the line, whether or not we need to submit comment letters, who else do we need to make aware that there's a comment letter due. So we cover this topic every week pretty in-depth. And so as we roll through these slides, we're going to have to bring those individuals up whose interests are directly at issue here with some of the matters that we're fighting in the statehood defense arena. Corey?
Yeah, so again, Corey Mills, for the record, I think all of you are aware of the statehood defense appropriations that have taken place by the legislature over since fiscal year 2021, but this is just a summary slide of that. I would just point out that where we're at now is you see that last tranche of funding that we got in fiscal year 2024. So we've spent through the rest of that with our various efforts. As a reminder, we have our federal laws and litigation report. Happy to provide that to anyone who wants it. I'll give it to the committee, Chair Giesel. But we've gone from about an average of 30 to 40 cases to now we have an active 80-plus cases in this arena, thus the need for the additional funding. So we're at our last $5 million tranche for the multi-year. Last year, the legislature did also give us what we call a temporary increment, which goes more into our base budget for natural resource work. So we're using both our multi-year as well as that additional funding to get us through. And it'll be interesting to see where we're at next year. We'll be able to evaluate that, but we feel like we're in a good place to get through fiscal year 2026.
And this slide is, you've probably all seen this slide 100 times. This is Senator Sullivan's famous executive orders and actions targeting Alaska slide. I only bring this up because I wanted to give some perspective of what we faced as a state over the last 4 years and sort of a caution that because we have an administration that seems to be more aligned with our interests doesn't mean that these are all going away. Some of these things we want to prevent from coming back in 4 more years, right? We don't want to see the same thing happen in 4 more years. So if we follow the litigation process all the way to its conclusion, hopefully with the U.S. Supreme Court in some of these cases, there will be no this waffling back and forth from administration to administration. We'll both benefit the state and the proponents to what the state are doing because we'll have certainty on those issues.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar had a question.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm starting here and also in the previous slides, you're talking about resources, waters, that kind of thing. But the appropriation is for statehood defense. And I guess we could start by the commandeering and the anti-commandeering doctrine. And perhaps, Ms. Mills, you want to speak to it a little bit. We now have new executive orders and new executive actions that essentially say, for example, with Maine right now, you will take a certain action or we will remove federal funding from you. How does those new EOs, none of which yet directly target Alaska, but some of which we saw the University of Alaska, for example, recently take an action because they were worried about an executive order that ostensibly required them to do something. And so we as a sovereign state are being commandeered by the executive to enact federal policy. So I'm wondering, will these kind of statehood defense funds also be used when our statehood sovereignty is impinged in that fashion?
May I, Senator Dunbar, through the chair?
Yes, Attorney General Trigg.
You know, accepting federal money has always come with strings, right? And that's how they enact a lot of what their policy is they offer you the money, you accept it based upon those certain stipulations. And so the federal government is at liberty to change those requirements for the states from time to time in regards to that money. I don't see statehood defense getting into that arena at all. That's not sort of our foundation that we're looking at. We're more interested, and when you look at the makeup of our committee, DEC, DNR, Fish and Game, those are sort of the meat and potatoes of what we do in statehood defense. It's those core issues that surrounded us even becoming a state, whether we could support ourselves as a state, whether we're going to be just a burden on the federal government. And so with those promises and our ability to utilize those resources in the way anticipated at statehood, any attempt by the federal government to prevent us from doing that is what we're talking about with statehood defense funds. And sort of a word of caution, and just because we have an administration that's more aligned with us on those particular issues doesn't mean that we're going to see a litigation load go down in the near future. In fact, I expect it, and I'm guessing that it'll go up in the near future because we're going to see a lot of litigation due to those executive actions that you're talking about, and we're going to be in a position of looking at those executive actions and deciding whether we're going to come in on the side of the NGO in those actions or deciding whether we're going to come in on the administration. But certainly Alaska will be intervening in those lawsuits to make sure its interests, Alaskan interests, are protected. And so as we sift through the caseload that we currently have, some of those probably can be settled, and we're okay with those settled. Others we want to get to a final decision to protect Alaska from here and into the future and have certainty on those issues. And then we're going to see a bunch of cases in the next term here that are due to the recent executive actions and either being in support or against those executive actions.
Thank you. Follow up, Senator Dunbar.
So what I'm hearing from you is none of these had to do with funding or threats to our funding, and so these were illegitimate because they were tied to land in some way. And your conception of statehood is it is about those lands, but not about our ability. You know, we have the police power, for example. And if the federal government says we'll cut your funding unless your public safety officers start, doing federal police actions, that doesn't fall in this pot of funds, at least, that we will need a different pot of funds for that. And that, so statehood defense means state resource defense and land defense, not the broader conception of state sovereignty. That's what you're saying?
That's Senator Dunbar, through the chair. That's what the meat and potatoes of statehood defense is. And one of the reasons why we probably wouldn't wade into that arena with these funds is because those are, I guess, more politicized issues, and we've tried to be very respectful with the statehood defense fund, only utilize them where we're going to have broad agreement amongst this body and the population in the use of those funds.
Well, I'll just note one last thing for the record, Madam Chair. You have the Pebble Mine on there and us defending the Pebble Mine. I do not think you have broad consensus in Alaska that we should be fighting for the Pebble Mine.
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I'll just respond quickly to that. So our issue with the Pebble Mine isn't with the Pebble Mine. Our issue is with the preemption by the EPA of that project. If they can do it to that project, they can do it to any project in Alaska. And so our issue is to make certain that we have certainty from the courts that we're asking the courts to say that they can't use that preemptive veto in that way to take over what is essentially a state function that mine is on state ground. So it's not a defense of the project itself. It's the defense of the ability of the state to permit a project on its own lands without interference like that from the federal government.
Thank you, General Taylor. Senator Wilikowski had a question.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for pointing that out. I noticed that several of these items on here are regarding Pebble Mine. There are several regarding the Willow Project, which ultimately was approved and is about to start producing oil soon. The question I had for you, though, was how come you don't have any of the Trump actions that are affecting Alaska on here? The $750 million in federal energy funds that have been halted, the wind farm permitting that's been halted, the state EV charging station funding, which has been halted. These are projects that have widespread support in this body, have widespread support from our congressional delegation, at least two members of our congressional delegation who voted for them. And there was a lawsuit filed by 22 attorney generals where a federal judge in Rhode Island recently ruled that the Trump administration defied a court order to unlock funding. And I'm curious whether you plan on joining that lawsuit and other lawsuits against the Trump administration for blocking hundreds of millions of dollars in desperately needed funds, funds that would go to a $55 million grant to Northwest Alaska Villages, $9 million to Kotzebue Electric Association, $200 million for the subsea line, which we need in South Central, $62 million in solar power funding all across Alaska, $52 million in vehicle charging stations, $132 million in a variety of other projects all across the country. Why didn't you intervene in that lawsuit claiming by 22 attorney generals that was a violation of the Impoundment Clause?
Senator Wolkowski, through the chair, first of all, the 67 executive orders in action starting in Alaska, that's a Senator Sullivan slide. I just wanted to put it there for illustrative purposes. In regards to those EOs and the actions taken by the Trump administration, if you remember the remarks that I made to Senator Dunbar, and that we have, as a state, have to decide whether, while we're more aligned with the federal government, there might be some actions that we take that are not going to be aligned. They'll be aligned with an NGO or somewhere else. You'll also notice that if you go through the list, as we go through this list of what sort of the litigation is currently ongoing in that statehood defenses, you'll notice it's not about receiving money. It's about our ability to develop the resources as Alaska sees fit. And so if we did take on those types of things, it would not be would be utilizing statehood defense funds.
All right. I see no further questions. Follow-up, Senator Wolkowski.
Will you be using any funds? This is, as you know, we have some of the highest energy costs in the world here in Alaska. And I would think that since 22 other attorney generals are standing up for this lawsuit, why wouldn't you join that lawsuit?
Senator Wolkowski, through the chair, these are all decisions that we're going to have to make. We, on a day-to-day basis, get requests to join litigation. We have to be strategic about which litigation we join and which we don't join in. And the policy choices that go into whether we join those litigations, I'm not a policymaker. I was not an elected official. I simply represent an elected official. And so as we analyze the right of the federal government to do that and what that harm is to Alaska, then we're going to make a policy recommendation. And based upon that recognition, we might engage in that type of litigation. We might not. It's all about what's the best use of these resources. Do we think that the action by the federal government has run afoul of the law? And what is the harm to Alaska in whether or not we are going to engage, or we let other states engage? There's many things that we are aligned. There's many actions taken against for example, the Biden administration that Alaska didn't join, and it was because it wasn't viewed as a wise stewardship of the state funds for us to engage, especially when there are so many capable states already engaged in that fight, and we thought that Alaska's interest in that litigation was already represented.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. So this is Corey Mills, and I'm going to kind of MC, I guess, a little bit. So I think we're going to bring up Acting Commissioner Christina Carpenter from the Department of Environmental Conservation. While she's coming up, I did just want to mention, which I should have before, when we're talking about the multi-year appropriation, as I said, we used to have around 40 actions. We moved to 80. The language for those multi-year appropriations was very restricted to resource protection and management, which is why you see the cases you do. It also didn't include being able to use that money on subsistence. That doesn't mean those aren't cases we're doing. It just means that funding was not used for that. So I want to be clear that, as Senator Wolkowski was pointing out, there are different fund sources, and that was kind of the parameters the legislature put around this particular funding. I'll hand it over.
All right. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Christina Carpenter. I'm the acting commissioner for the Department of Environmental Conservation. I have three slides for the committee today. The first is an overview of the primacy programs that are currently implemented by DEC. And primacy is a term that I believe most of the committee is familiar with, but it refers to when Congress passes a law, the federal government can delegate authority for states to implement that law within the state borders. DEC was established in 1971, and we received our first primacy approval for the Safe Drinking Water Act in 1978. And since then, we've been successfully regulating public water systems across the state. And over the past almost 50 years since we received primacy for CIDWA, we've added a number of other primacy programs to our department, including the Clean Air Act, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. Apologies for the typo on the slide. That's where we regulate pesticides across the state. We also have a primacy for portions of the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, also known as RCRA, which regulates waste. And the last primacy program that we received approval for was Section 402 for the Clean Water Act. And that is our APDES program, the Alaska Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, which gives us the authority to authorize wastewater discharges in waters across the state. And why is primacy important? You know, essentially, this is Alaskans regulating Alaskans. While we can't be less restrictive than federal law allows, we do have the local expertise to work with our stakeholders and our regulated community to provide enforcement discretion and look at alternatives that aren't necessarily easily considered when the federal government is looking at things from a national policy perspective. This next slide highlights some of the current and future uses that we have been using statehood defense for. The first is WOTUS, Waters of the United States. Since the Sackett decision in 2013, we haven't seen much change with the way that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is implementing the WOTUS. We are still waiting for guidelines, and most of the decisions that have been coming out of U.S. Army Corps of Engineer headquarters have been on a case-by-case basis, which is creating a patchwork of guidance from the various regions that don't provide clear guidance to the regulated industry. So we are working with our fellow resource agencies and contractors to try to develop guidance that we can provide to Alaskans, to the Alaska regulated community, so that they can more easily identify jurisdictional wetlands, predict permit application timelines, and identify compensatory mitigation options early in the process. The other topic that has been discussed at DEC recently is our Fairbanks PM 2.5 non-attainment area. I will say that DEC is extremely proud of the years of work that DEC staff and EPA staff have been working together to work with local stakeholders to try to improve the air quality in Fairbanks. And we are fully supportive of EPA's planned approval of our state implementation plan. That said, we fully expect that there will be some legal challenges. And so in the future, we hope to support EPA's planned approval of our SIP. And that may require legal support.
Yes, Senator Kawasaki has a question.
Thanks. This is from the interior side of things, and Fairbanks has been dealing with air quality, as you know, for many, many years. The question, though, that you just said, one of the
one of the issues, and the realtors are in town right now today, one of the approved portions of the state implementation plan that was signed off by this administration and EPA was basically it was that realtors, before they sell, have to have a energy rating performed before that house be sold. And I can just tell you that the discussion from realtors in our districts have been that it's incredibly hard to comply with. It will mean that beginning at the end of December, they will have to comply with this new rule. We have, I guess, only two energy raters in the Fairbanks area right now. And so I guess everybody's kind of worried about that. And I just wanted to let you know, because realtors are in town, does that mean that since the state approved the plan, the regulations are in place now, that the attorney general will defend the plan in front of EPA? If it comes to, for instance, some folks that are maybe the realtors, I guess, are going to be opposed to it. Just one portion of the plan.
Yeah. Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, I would like to say thank you to the Interior delegation. I know that you guys have been meeting with our Air Quality Division Director, Jason Olds, and your staff have as well, and getting informed on the issue. So I very much appreciate your engagement. So we are supportive of EPA's planned approval for the non-discretionary section of our state implementation plan. There is a method if our SIP gets approved, we do have the ability to pursue a demonstration that will modify our plan after any sort of court proceedings. We also have we're working with EPA currently. We've heard that they plan to reopen the public comment period specific to that energy audit requirement based upon the feedback that they're getting. And once they do reopen that, we will let interested parties know so that they can engage as well. That said, in the meantime, we are also working with AHFC to try to expand the list of energy auditors available. We're also pursuing grant opportunities in the event that that those energy audit requirements could provide or could provide a financial impact to home sellers and home buyers. And all of that said is that we intend to pursue all of the administrative discretion opportunities that we currently have to ensure that DEC doesn't create a bottleneck in the home sales in the Fairbanks area.
Follow up,
Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, some of this was generated because of a lot of the discussion with Department of Transportation, and so transportation funding that might be at stake because we're not complying with EPA regulations when it comes to air quality within the watershed in the Fairbanks area and the federal municipal transit area. So why doesn't the Attorney General fight that issue as opposed to letting this one go through? And I guess that's a decision that was made, but that question is probably more directed toward the Attorney General.
So through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, and
we identifying could, yourself for the record.
Yeah, Corey Mills again for the record. We could bring up Treg if we want to, the Attorney General, but this was a consultation with the Department of Environmental Conservation, and I don't think we're all the way through yet. I think there's still decisions that could be made, but I think at this point the decision has been made through the policy folks as to how to approach the issue.
Okay.
All right. You may go on. Oh, Senator Klayman.
What is the timeline on when you expect the plan to be approved? It sounds like it's still in process. Do you have a time when you expect it'll be finally approved?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, I know that EPA had published their plan to approve, and that initial public comment period closed, I believe, on February 7th. Now that they are now that they have indicated that they're going to reopen the public comment period, I don't have an updated timeline for you, but I can follow up with the committee in writing.
Thank you. Further questions on this topic? All right, I'll let you move on.
All right. My last slide for the committee is just a couple of successes that I wanted to highlight with these funds. In 2021, DEC issued 548 notices of intent to sue the federal government for their failure to clean up contaminated sites that were conveyed to Alaska Native corporations with the ANCSA in 1971. And while those lawsuits were either dismissed or they have been stayed by the court, it has spurred action on Congress's part. They've appropriated $40 million towards the cleanup of those sites. DEC has also received a $7 million appropriation that allows us to work with our federal agencies to develop an inventory and track the progress of those cleanups on a publicly available database. And this is important in terms of holding the federal government accountable, making sure that the public is informed about the cleanup progress and ensuring that there's continued progress towards those sites. And then our EPA wood stove certification program. DEC is not resourced to regulate national manufactured wood stoves or wood burning devices. We're not California. We don't want to be California. We would like EPA to do their job, and that is to develop regulations so that wood burning stove manufacturers are providing clean burning stoves. And the current regulations have a number of loopholes and testing issues. And so DEC and law were successful in suing EPA and ensuring that they update those regulations to make sure that wood stoves are actually clean burning and their testing methods are accurate.
Thank you. I have a question, Acting Commissioner. Can a home in Fairbanks use a wood stove today?
Senator Giesel, yes, they can.
What hoops do they have to jump through to do that?
Chair Giesel, they would need to be using an approved manufacturing device from one of the list of the approved manufacturers.
So I may have misunderstood, but I thought you said the DEC hadn't done its work in identifying clean burning wood stoves, certifying them. Perhaps I'm confused.
Chair Giesel, apologies. EPA hasn't developed regulations that ensure that the wood burning stoves that are currently approved by EPA are actually clean burning and meeting the testing requirements. And so we have sued EPA and compelled them to update their regulations so that we can ensure that future stoves available for sale in the Fairbanks area are clean burning.
Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, can I have a question about that, because you probably weren't around during that time, but was there any challenge from EPA saying that they wouldn't do it? It seems like EPA wants to do this. The prior administration, the Biden administration, would want to see clean burning wood stoves and have a pretty specific and effective way to certify those. Is it not the case, or did they fight? And did the state of Alaska actually have to spend money against the prior administration?
So this is Corey Mills for the record. We were trying to recall. It's been a while since we looked at this, since we brought this litigation previously. I believe, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, that it had to do more with the requirements didn't make sense the way they were coming out. They weren't they were coming out with standards that were inconsistent with other standards they had. And so it was not going to be able to be complied with. But I can get back to you on that case and probably find it here as we're talking. I can look it up and remind myself of exactly what the challenge was. But that's just my recollection.
Okay. And then
yes, follow up.
Yeah, follow up on the other one regarding I can't remember what they're called, the wells. The wells that needed to be cleaned up from former DOI land, the travesty wells, that's what we called them. That's how we referred them. Was there any pushback with the administration on actually getting those things done, or was it a funding issue, or was it a – can you explain sort of that issue?
Well, Corey Mills again, through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. I'll start, and I don't know. DEC had a lot more conversations at that level in terms of the litigation. What had happened to date is there wasn't the funding being produced for it. They were not providing lists of the contaminated sites so that we knew exactly where they were. There was there had been a lack of effort, despite I know Senator Murkowski in particular was pushing this issue, and frankly none of the prior administrations had done much of an effort on it. I will say that I think the real push here was by doing the lawsuit. What resulted was additional funds going towards these sites. It's not enough. It's not enough to get them done, but we were able to get some movement on additional money really devoted to attacking this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, I see no further questions.
Okay, and Chair Giesel, Corey Mills again, I see that we're already getting low on time, so I wasn't sure where you wanted us to go from here. Briefly, on the next slide, I'll probably bring up, I think Commissioner Boyle is next, so I'll probably have him come up briefly on 404C. This is our case regarding the Pebble Mine deposit. It is not challenging a denial of, the general permit. It is challenging what we call the 404C determination. Just to remind everyone, this is a determination, basically an EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, veto of an entire swath of land. This particular veto was larger, I think, than any other that had occurred. It was 300 square miles, so it was much larger than the actual footprint, and it basically would stop any action from happening, not just the particular action of the mine that had been proposed. And so we have two actions happening in this regard. One is a challenge saying this was an improper use of the 404C veto, and the other is actually if it was a proper action, then the federal government has effectively restricted the state from pursuing its mineral rights on those 300 square miles, and therefore we should be compensated for that amount. So there are two concurrent issues moving forward. The second one on the Court of Claims is what we call it, is stayed while we proceed with, was this a lawful action to begin with? So with that, I'm going to move on to if Commissioner Boyle wants to come forward for the Department of Natural Resources.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Giesel and honorable members of the Senate Resources Committee. For the record, this is John Boyle. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and unless people want to talk about agriculture, I can jump into statehood defense. Sorry, it's a little bit of gallows humor. I get it. There's really two big prongs of DNR's interest as it relates to statehood defense. The first is really our navigability determination. So as our legal scholars that sit on the committee are well aware, you know, under the Equal Footing Doctrine, under the Federal Submerged Lands Act, and under the Alaska Statehood Act, provided that Alaska should receive title, and in fact, we do own the submerged lands and every navigable, in fact, entirely influenced river, lake, and other water body, you know, within our borders, except under very narrow circumstances where there may have been a specific articulated federal withdrawal of those areas. And, of course, this is a fundamental promise of our statehood, as all of you are well aware. Our waterways formed the original and continuing transportation network across our state, from our indigenous peoples to the sourdoughs that came up here looking for riches in our lands, our rivers, our lakes, our water bodies that connected communities and areas. I mean, these were essential for the settlement of the state, for the utilization of the state's resources, and continue to be for access, for hunting, for fishing, you know, for myriad other uses. And so fundamentally, the state having title, recognized title, and management authority over these areas is important, as it is a essential element to our state being able to go about doing its business. Unlike most other states, we are now 66 years in having the federal government acknowledge the state's ownership of what we estimate to be roughly 800,000 miles of navigable rivers and over 30 million acres of navigable lakes. And of those two figures, our estimate is right now, the federal government has only acknowledged Alaska's clear title to roughly 9% of our submerged lands under state-owned river and just under 16% of our submerged lands under state-owned lakes. So again, 16% of the 30 million acres under navigable lakes and 9% under the 800 miles of navigable rivers in the state. So this is a significant amount of land that we're talking about. And of course, this uncertainty over management and ownership has myriad implications. Of course, we're all aware of the Sturgeon case and his desire, of course, to be able to utilize a specific type of craft in order to go hunting. But more than that, we have issues where Alaska Native corporations, for example, have selected what are state-owned submerged lands, yet to be acknowledged by the federal government. And those state lands which they've selected have been debited from – sorry, I'm not an accountant, so I always have to remember which one is which. But they should have actually more right to select lands than they have, because they've selected lands that are, in fact, state lands that, again, transferred to the state ownership under the Equal Footing Doctrine and the Federal Submerged Lands Act and the Statehood Act, so on and so forth, but just haven't been acknowledged by the federal government. So there's a significant amount of lands that our Alaska Native corporations are still entitled, that they should be able to select, that they can put those lands into productive economic use for their shareholders. And so resolving these issues of ownership and these navigability determinations is a key priority for the department, and I think it should be a key priority for the state. So, you know, we've endeavored on multiple occasions to, including with the help of our congressional delegation, to find processes to work with the agencies to establish, again, some kind of protocol, a process, a way for us to more easily and outside of the court to find a pathway to make these determinations. But unfortunately, you know, those efforts have frequently stalled out. The federal government has reprioritized other initiatives, and they either haven't funded or haven't staffed the positions necessary to help the state resolve. And so, you know, much of our litigation then is based on a lot of work that we do. You know, I have within my Division of Mining, Land, and Water our public access assertion and defense team, which we, for short, we call the PAD team. That's led by Mr. Jim Walker, whom I believe many of you have had the privilege to meet. You know, Jim and his team have the greatest job in the state. They get to go float the most beautiful rivers across the state to collect evidence of navigability. And, of course, then we select some of those yet-to-be-acknowledged rivers, navigable rivers, to then challenge the federal government in court. So that, in a nutshell, that's really our primary focus and effort there. And then, as also was mentioned, the next kind of layer of DNR's interest in statehood defense does revolve around decisions with land or resource management. So in particular, the Biden administration's actions on the MPRA and the MPRA management plan, undoing the integrated activity plan that the Trump administration had worked to implement, and instituting a management structure there, which we believe comes at the severe detriment of being able to develop more resources, both on federal land but also on state lands and submerged lands that are adjacent to the MPRA that, for instance, might be impacted by the inability to build infrastructure that would enable resources produced on state land or near shore waters from being able to traverse through the National Petroleum Reserve. We're also, of course, have initiatives in terms of establishing the proper boundary. We have a dispute between the state and the federal government on where the boundary of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge actually begins, between the Canning and the Staines River. That's a continued important ongoing effort. The state's position would increase the amount of lands potentially available for state leasing within ANWR. And then, of course, we have just kind of their general management structure there. And then, lastly, I know we have issues related to the Outer Continental Shelf, both the withdrawal in areas that have been taken off the table preemptively by the administration, but also the actions that they've taken in Cook Inlet to make federal leasing more challenging. You know, that's another key initiative that we are working on there. So I guess in a nutshell, that these are what DNR is working on. I know we have our legal beagles that are here to kind of get into the specific of some of the cases.
Thank you. Were those folks going to come forward, or
so
would questions?
Chair Giesel, I think just based on time, what I'd ask is if the committee has any questions. We do have Ron Opsahl on the line to talk about navigability. We also have Mary Gramling in the room to talk about those oil and gas cases. So if we have questions, happy to take those. But in the interest of time, I'm happy to also move on. I think the commissioner kind of summarized the reason for all of these types of litigation.
Okay, so let's pause for a moment. First of all, it is my intent to complete this presentation. I know that there's another commissioner yet to speak, but I understand some of you may have to go, right? You have other meetings. But are there any questions related to the cases that appear on the screen? There are four of them, and any of the experts that are available to speak to them? Seeing none. Very good. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And here are the, again, Corey Mills for the record, here are the oil and gas cases. In case anyone wants further detail on those, we can bring up our expert, Mary Gramling.
Any questions on these particular areas?
Okay.
Seeing none. Thank you.
Then I will bring up Chris Orman.
Okay.
He's an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law. This is another case that catches the news a lot. We thought it was important to include on tribal territorial jurisdiction and lands into trust. So I will hand it over to Chris.
Hi, committee. Good afternoon. My name is Christopher Orman, for the record, Department of Law. So there's two cases to talk about here. They're on the left-hand side, and they're two different issues, but they're interrelated, and the way the litigation played out is very interesting. So the first is lands into trust. And just putting that into context, some of you probably heard that there was a 780-square-foot parcel that Clinton and Haida moved to place into trust that was in downtown Juneau. The ultimate question that the state asked in the litigation, in the complaint that it filed, was to what extent the assistant secretary at BIA had the authority to place those lands in a trust. Now, the reason why we moved forward with that litigation was that we had been seeing that depending on the administration that was in place, there were different decisions and, how should I say this, different views on whether or not the secretary had that power and that ability to place those lands in a trust. And so effectively, the litigation was filed to try to get an answer. Then instead of waiting for one administration to change their view on whether or not that authority existed, or another administration step in and come up with a different view, that we have a court look at it. So ultimately, the case was in front of Judge Gleason. Judge Gleason provided a decision that sided with us on two of the issues, did not side with us on the main issue that we asked and pushed, which was whether or not the secretary had that authority to place lands in a trust. We've since appealed the decision to the Ninth Circuit. The Central Council of Clinton and Haida also appealed, as did the federal government. Obviously, we've had an administration change since that appeal decision was made by the federal government. A few things that are going on before the Ninth Circuit just recently, Central Council of Clinton and Haida just this last Friday moved to dismiss the appeal. We internally are still reviewing that and determining, obviously, next steps in that case.
Very good. I see no questions.
So I did kind of foreshadow a little bit that these cases are a little bit interrelated because when we were before Judge Gleason on the lands in a trust litigation, we had included some analysis in our briefing regarding native allotments. Right as the briefing cycle was about to end, suddenly an M opinion was issued that came out with a new opinion, an M opinion by the secretary, that suggested that, well, Alaska tribes had territorial jurisdiction over native allotments in Alaska. That was kind of a big deal in the context of our lands in a trust case because we were pointing out there's not really Indian country and tribes don't have a land base within Alaska. That M opinion that kind of pushed aside 30 years of what was well understood that Alaska tribes did not have jurisdiction over native allotments, suddenly it changed overnight with that M opinion. This case, as far as the litigation and what's been filed, those of you on this panel will all know about this. Native Village of Aklutna is proceeding with a casino and gaming operation on what was and is a native allotment. That allotment is named the Ondola Allotment. What makes this case really interesting is that in 2021, the D.C. Circuit Court determined that the Ondola Allotment was not Indian lands under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act and therefore was not eligible for gaming. So suddenly, and we have the administration with a different perspective, a different view, come up with a different decision and proceeds to tell the Native Village of Aklutna that gaming is appropriate on that exact same allotment. So this is, again, a case in which we're trying to seek resolution on an issue in which I think at the core both of these cases have a fascinating separation of powers issue to be considered. What's the role of the courts in analyzing this? How far can administrations and the executive branch make changes and have decisions that result and consequences and potentially now push back on decisions that courts have made? And so ultimately, I think, you know, that's really what sparked this litigation, then, you know, as far as native allotments, is just trying to get an answer.
Very good. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you all.
So Corey Mills, again, for the record, I'm going to bring up Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang to talk about the Department of Fish and Game.
Good morning, Madam Chair, honored members of the committee. I'm Doug Vincent Lang. I'm the commissioner for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Before we go to the next slide, you know, the best opportunity to engage in issues with the federal government isn't in lawsuits. Lawsuits take a lot of time, take a lot of money, and have uncertain outcomes. So, you know, we engage in lawsuits when we need to, but we do really try to work with the federal government to ensure that they understand the law, they understand the history of Alaska, and that they understand the science that we often collect on fish and game resources and try to inform their decisions up front. So We do spend a lot of money in collecting science to inform our lawsuits or inform better decision-making by the federal government. And only if we get an outcome that is really not in alignment with either state policy or state science do we enter into the lawsuit arena. So next slide, please. So we basically operate in three different areas. One is protect Alaska's right to manage our state fish and game resources and their uses. Second area we have is to ensure the best available information is being used in the federal permitting process. Then finally, we do challenge unnecessary and justified listings of the of species and their critical habitats under the Endangered Species Act. So right to manage. You know, our state was founded on really a fight over who was managing fish and game resources. That was one of the fundamental issues of why we became a state. Alaska's Statehood Compact gave us real control over fish and game management. You know, we spent a lot of time as part of the statehood, the development of the Constitution. We put sustained yield in our Constitution. We developed a whole management program. We developed a research program. And as a result, on December 29, 1959, President Eisenhower formally recognized a transfer of authority over fish and game to the state of Alaska with an executive order. These rights were really reaffirmed with the passage of ANILCA. Let me make that clear. Nothing in ANILCA changed the fundamental right that, of primacy regarding fish and game management. It allowed the federal government to step in when they felt that the rights of rural subsistence users were not being provided for by the state, but that only gave them the ability to restrict or close fisheries and hunts. Since that time, we've seen a complete replacement of state management with federal management. That is opening and having the entire management control, developing a whole regulatory program on federal lands. So why is this important? Well, Alaskans must have the ability to access fish and game resources without being unnecessarily restricted. When they're being the largest native community in the state of Alaska is Anchorage. Under federal management, people in Anchorage that have long historically practiced their cultural practices are disallowed from practicing subsistence on federal lands. So we're very interested in trying to – we have a subsistence priority. We take that seriously. And only unless those subsistence needs aren't being met in those local areas do we think it's wrong to disallow people that have traditionally grown but are displaced for economic reasons, cultural reasons, other reasons from participating in those hunting opportunities. We also see a whole wide variety of other issues. Like they take land and they put de facto wilderness designations on it, which basically disallow access from traditional ways of accessing those federal lands. We've also seen 17B easements, challenges to those, and those were agreements that we had in place with the federal government when we created all this federal land as parks and refuges to guarantee that Alaskans can continue to access those lands. Next slide, please. The other thing we do is we use the best available science to inform federal decision-making. So, next slide. So, like when we got hit with the ESA petition on Chinook salmon, first thing we did is we didn't sue that was unwarranted. We basically sat back and collected our science. And we basically wrote, I can't remember what it was, a very long memo or data sheet and gave it to the federal government and said, here's the science for it. We don't think a science justifies a listing, but here it is. We also put two of our chief scientists on the status review team. They're non-voting members, but they're able to correct the record. It's our hope by taking that effort and using some of these funds that you've given us to inform them, to put that record in place, that we're going to come out with an informed decision that we see as the right decision. And only after that may we necessarily have to go. We built a record that we could use for defense of it legally in the legal arena. Pacific walrus listing. We prevented a listing of Pacific walrus. Again, we were the primary people collecting information. Some of that money came from statehood defense. But that science basically prevented the listing of Pacific walrus. We have a whole list of species that are currently being considered for listing. Wolves in southeast Alaska, bog lemming. I have that list here someplace. But western bumblebee, McCabe's bumblebee, large marble butterfly, sunflower sea star, glacier buttercup. All of these are species that have most of the information on, not the federal agencies. When we get hit with a petition, we go out and collect the science. We put the science together. We give that to the federal agency. We try to talk them through it. And in many cases, we have prevented listings. We've prevented listings of southeast Alaska wolves. We prevented listing of Where's I? Missed here. Well, next slide. I think it's on. We present a listing of about 14 different species now. Yeah. Wolves of Southeast Alaska, bull kelp, Stuckley's butterfly, bumblebee, Pacific walrus, Lake Ileana the seals, tusked puffin, Kitsilet's murrelet, yellow cedar, shortfin mako shark. In each of these cases, if these species had been listed, we'd be seeing critical habitat designated for them. We'd be seeing significant impacts for species that really didn't justify a listing because they weren't present in Alaska, or that they, or that the subspecies is more abundant than they thought in Alaska. So by informing those decisions up front, by working with the federal agencies, we were able to prevent designations that required then ESA protections as well as critical habitat designations. So we also, in terms of informed participation, we involve ourselves in the Federal Subsistence Board. We are not a voting member in the Federal Subsistence Board, but we try to make sure that they have the available information in front of them. For instance, when they made a decision to close deer hunting in Southeast Alaska here, we made a special effort to say, listen, we considered subsistence hunting. We're providing ANS under the state program. There's no need to restrict hunting in these areas around these communities. We tried our best, and now we're trying to do that through an appeal process before we go to court over those issues. Same thing is happening up in Northwest Alaska with caribou. We try our best through the regulatory process to inform that decision process. It builds a record in case we're unsuccessful, but we try our best to work with them to inform their decisions moving forward. And only when it comes down to it do we involve and participate in lawsuits to defend federal actions that we don't think are necessary. Right now we're intervening in the polar bear incidental take regulations. Those regulations are critical towards oil and gas industry in the North Slope. They moved from an incidental take regulation that was very specific to look at the take of bears due to oil and gas activities that was based on real data, and they moved into a modeling scenario. And that modeling scenario assumed, based on snow depth, that there was, in Anwar, there was sufficient snow depth to have polar bear dens almost anywhere on there. And then they basically said, if you have this activity, it's going to result in a displacement, model displacement of X number of bears that were an incidental take. Well, when we actually went out and modeled snow depth, we found out that almost 75 or 80% of the area didn't have sufficient snow depth to create a polar bear den. So we're working with them to readjust their models again to hopefully get the number of takes down so that we can have expanded oil and gas activities on the North Slope. And the same thing with Cook Inlet incidental take regulations. We are trying our best to work with National Marine Fisheries Service to get more reasonable incidental take regulations associated with Cook Inlet beluga whales. Next slide. We are challenging a few decisions. Ring seals, so there's 3 to 7 million ring seals in the world right now. National Marine Fisheries Service listed them as a threatened species because sometime from 70 to 100 years into the future, they might become extinct because of climate change, and they designated critical habitat for those species. We challenged the listing. We are appealing that decision right now because we lost it in front of Judge Gleason. We also were told by National Marine Fisheries Service that we couldn't even consider a delisting petition for them until the end of the century because that's when the threats are going to come to them. So there could be 10 million ring seals and we would still be listed. We'd still have them listed as an endangered species and have the regulatory oversight with them. And then ringed and bearded seal critical habitat. We want a major lawsuit on seal ice habitat, critical habitat. They designated an area larger than, I think, the size of Texas. It was anywhere where a seal currently exists and might exist in 100 years from now. And a judge ruled that was a little extensive and threw out the entire critical habitat designation and asked them to revisit it. Mm-hmm. Next slide. So the current litigation we have going on is challenge finding regarding the state's petition to delist Arctic ring seals I spoke about earlier, challenge to critical habitat designations for Arctic ring seals and bearded seals, a Metlakatla fishery jurisdiction. This is a case where Metlakatla is one of the few areas of tribal jurisdiction in the state of Alaska. At statehood, they were given a zone around the island that they had exclusive rights to. Outside that zone, CFEC, when had limited entry, gave historical permits out to different Metlakatlans that lived on the island, and they basically participated in fisheries outside their exclusive zone. Well, since then, they've sold a lot of those permits, and now they're suing the state saying that they're they should be able to fish wherever based on tribal rights outside the zone of their exclusive zone there. So we're challenging that. That has significant impacts on other fishermen that are fishing in those state water jurisdiction areas that could potentially have huge impacts on how we're managing those fisheries because they don't want to be managed underneath the state management plans. And then Cook Inlet salmon management, we're suing over the federal management in the EEZ in Cook Inlet. The basic question there is USITA would like to have federal management all the way up into the tributaries of Cook Inlet, and we just don't think that's appropriate. So thank you. I'll be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions? Not seeing any. Thank you.
Okay, Corey Mills again for the record. I think the next few slides are really the lawsuits that Commissioner Vincent Lang already spoke about. So I think I'll go through these again and just ask if there's questions and we can bring up the expert if needed. So the first is the Southeast Alaska Chinook Fishery Biological Opinion. This is the Wild Fish Conservancy case that was discussed, and I didn't know if there were any questions about this. This would have shut down a lot of commercial fishing in Southeast Alaska, and we were successful in getting that. The remedy was not to shut it down. There is going to be a new biological opinion, but the fishing can continue in the meantime.
Yes. I see no questions.
Okay. And then the marine mammal litigation, that was also discussed. Both of those, the 90-day finding regarding the state's petition to delist, as well as the critical habitat that Commissioner Vincent Lang discussed. Okay. And off-reservation fishing rights, again, this has to do with the Metlakatla Indian community and their desire to not have to follow the CFEC, Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, permitting requirements.
And again, I see no questions.
Okay. Then I think we came to the very end of the presentation. So
thank you very much, Ms. Mills. General Taylor, Commissioner Boyle, Commissioner Vincent Lang, and Acting Commissioner Carpenter, thank you for being here. Thank you for the presentation. So with that concludes our agenda for today. Our next meeting will be next week on Monday, and we will be announcing the agenda tomorrow afternoon when typical the announcements come out. So at this time, we will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 5:22 p.m.